Good morning to all of you. I'd like to welcome you to the Migration Policy Institute. My name is Kathleen Newland, and I direct MPI's Refugee Policy Program. Today's briefing, as you know, is a discussion of the situation of Colombian refugees in Panama and Ecuador. And we are going to be discussing the observations and findings from a trip organized by the Refugee Council USA to the region. Two of our three speakers were on that mission, along with several others from the Jesuit Refugee Services, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the International Rescue Committee, the Lutheran Immigration Refugee Services, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, the Canadian Council for Refugees, the Women's Refugee Commission, the Episcopal Church, and the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. So this was a very wide-ranging delegation that visited the areas of refugee settlement in Panama and Ecuador. We are very pleased to have three speakers to discuss the situation of Colombian refugees this morning. As you know, it's a very long-standing refugee situation. And I think it's fair to say one of the most neglected in the wider discussion of refugee problems worldwide. Our panel is going to begin with Andrea Lari, who is the Director of Regions at Refugees International. And he's going to start by talking to us about the situation inside Colombia that is generating so much displacement, both internally and externally. Next, Shayna Aber, who's Associate Advocacy Director for Jesuit Refugee Services USA, is going to talk about the situation of Colombian refugees in Panama. And Melanie Neeser, Senior Director for U.S. Policy and Advocacy at the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, is going to discuss the situation of Colombian refugees in Ecuador. You all have fuller biographies of our speakers on your chairs, in the material that was left on your chairs, and their accomplishments are so many and various that if I introduce them fully into our time, so I hope you'll forgive me for not doing that and refer you to the printed bios. I also want to mention that the photos we had rotating earlier on the screen were taken by Refugee Council USA members on this delegation to Panama and Ecuador, and also during some earlier trips to the region. The pictures included images of Colombian refugees, the housing they're living in, the schools that their children have access to in some cases, and the neighborhoods and communities in which these refugees are living in Panama and Colombia. The delegation in its discussions with policymakers, with refugees, with people who are helping refugees in the region, were able to highlight the very complex protection issues that arise in connection with Colombian refugees, their need for durable solutions, including local integration and resettlement. And when we have, after the speakers have made a presentation, we'll have a good amount of time for discussion. And if there are additional questions that occur to you after the panel, RCUSA has made clear that you're very welcome to contact them at any time, and their contact details are on the back cover of the report, copies of which you also have with you. So without further ado, let me invite Andrea Lari from Refugees International to talk to us about the situation in Colombia. Thanks, Andrea.
Thank you very much, Kathleen, and I really like to thank the MPI for giving me the opportunity to share with you some of Refugees International work on Colombian forced displacement. I think that many of you know what is Refugees International. Very briefly, we are a humanitarian advocacy organization that doesn't provide any immediate emergency for development assistance, but we do missions in areas where there are forced displacement situations. We talk to the displaced people, the refugees, and then with our analysis and several interviews, we come back to the United States. And in Washington and New York, we do humanitarian advocacy, and we push for greater humanitarian assistance, a better protection for these groups. We are totally independent. We do not receive any money from the U.S. government or any other government and the United Nations. So we enjoy, let's say, some latitude in terms of putting some issues on the table and being a bit more aggressive with policymakers when it comes to change policies. In terms of Colombia, we have been working on Colombia displacement since the beginning of 2005, visiting regularly inside Colombia for the following 4 or 5 years. And in the last couple of years, we also started to assess the situation in the bordering country hosting Colombian refugees. I was lucky enough to be part of almost every mission from 2005, so I think that I was able to develop some kind of a perspective analysis on how the conflict situation in the country has developed. And what I've seen over a period of time is that the policies of the Uribe administration, of other patriotic plan or the democratic security, was a policy hinged on two basic objectives, performing counterinsurgency and counter-narcotics strategies, tackling two of the priorities in terms of debt administration, just reducing the production and availability of coca, and also reducing the capacity of the illegal armed groups, and particularly the FARC or the ELN. What we saw over a period of time is that the conflict, I mean, this policy and these military operations did succeed to clear several portions of the country and secure major arteries within the major cities in the departments, but also push the conflict much closer to the borders and much more deep into rural areas in Colombia. this is one of the reasons why the number of Colombian refugees in the last few years, refugees that cross the borders into other Ecuador, Panama, and Venezuela increased. So this dynamic of that type of conflict was happening in Colombia. But what kind of reasons are Colombians fleeing from? What kind of causes? What kind of situations are causing people to cross the border? Well, it's a combination of different violent effects. Some of the dynamics of the Colombian conflict are the following. Illegal armed groups, other former or reorganized or criminal gangs, as they are called now, they are battling the FARC for the control of other strategic areas in Colombia, strategic from the point of view of cultivation, harvesting, transiting, producing, processing and transiting of illegal crops, and also there's been fighting among these groups to secure control over communities for several reasons. Again, for territorial control and for using manpower to process illegal activities. Another reason of the cause displacement is the counterinsurgency and counter-narcotic policies implemented by the National Army and the police. They're actually going aggressively after those illegal armed groups, in particular the FARC and the ELN, and civilians are oftentimes caught into the crossfire. There has been an increasing targeting of displaced communities, indigenous communities, and Afro-Colombian communities leaders by these illegal armed groups. Displacement, forced displacement, is a process, is a phenomenon that has been affecting Colombia for more than 40 years. We have a recognized number of internally displaced persons of 3.670,000 people. Excuse me. This is the official figure that the Presidential Agency for Social Action and International Cooperation is sharing in public. So 3.67 million. And there has been a decrease in the last couple of years. This has been recognized. The government of Colombia 2 years ago, in the beginning of last year, said there was a decrease of 80% in terms of displacement. Now, figure from 2 days ago, in terms of displacement from 2009 and 2010, the reduction has been of 40% only. So in 2009, we had 160,000 newly displaced, and in 2010, 110,000 newly displaced people. This means a very serious and continuing humanitarian crisis. Despite some of the information that the government of Colombia is putting out there, saying that the situation is normalizing, the situation is not normalizing. I mean, with more than 100,000 people displaced every year, this is a very serious humanitarian crisis. So what we saw in the couple of years ago when we visited Venezuela and Ecuador, we saw that some of the same dynamics, of the conflict dynamics that were particularly indicative of the situation in Colombia, were spilling over into northern Ecuador, into southwestern Venezuela, and I don't talk about Panama because my colleagues will be more detailed on that, but this was pretty evident. We had the presence of newly organized criminal gangs or former paramilitaries, or the combination of the two, in villages and cities in Ecuadorian territory. We had presence of the FARC in rural areas, in forested areas in Ecuadorian territory. We had presence of the FARC and the ELN in Venezuelan territory, with bases that have been identified not accurately. I mean, we could definitely say that when we visited Venezuela, we did encounter illegal armed groups, members of the illegal armed groups ourselves. We did an exchange dialogue with them, and we saw them. And in some of the cities in western Venezuela, there is an increase in developing of some of these paramilitary groups that or criminal gangs that we mentioned. So it is pretty evident. Another dynamic is this terrorization of the civil society and communities. I let my colleagues go in details, but the increasing number of murders and violence in cities inside Ecuador, along the border. We also saw an increased militarization of these bordering areas from the side of Venezuela and Ecuador, with more army being sent. I mean, in terms of Venezuela, the government has called or is considering all the Venezuelan territory in the West as theater of war. So we are, according to their perspective, we are in a situation of war there. So with all the possible consequences for the civilian population and for those crossing into those countries. As I said, the Uribe policy did contribute significantly in the increase of Colombian refugees crossing into the border. The reconfiguration of the paramilitaries all into different groups that are much less organized and are much less easy to identify and to battle in terms of how they were the paramilitaries group in the 90s are also contributing to this spillover. And there has been an increased number of individuals and leaders inside Colombia that have tried to seek sanctuary in these bordering countries. So internally displaced persons that when they flee from their own community, normally the people go from rural community to urbanized community and from small cities to bigger cities. And sometimes within bigger cities like Bogota or Medellin, they circle from neighborhood to neighborhood because they get continuously persecuted. I mean, I personally interviewed a couple of Colombian refugees coming from Tumaco, that is in Nariño, all the way down border with Ecuador, in Caracas, just to give you an idea how terrible is the situation for some of these leaders. So I don't know how much time I have, but I just wanted to wrap up here and saying basically that from our current analysis, despite improvement in security inside Colombia, and despite military success against the FARC, the situation is not over at all. Conflict is lingering is more fragmented, but is still very intense in different areas of the country. Fumigation are still happening. Of illegal crop is still happening. Very recently, from December to January, there have been several massive displacement inside Colombia because of fumigation in the Antioquia area. Just to give you an idea, massive displacement for the Colombian terminology means that more than 10 families or 50 individuals at the same time, so just to give an idea. So these kind of violent situations are still happening. Fighting between different illegal armed groups is still happening, and the situation of Colombian crossing into bordering countries is not a reality that is going to go away anytime soon. Therefore, we will need to listen from our colleagues here and see what are the major recommendations in helping people and how to improve the situation. And before wrapping up, I'd like to just put on the table one point that is an issue that came across from last week when I was in Bogota talking to some government official from Colombia. And there seems to be an increasing enthusiasm and desire from the Colombian government to have Colombian refugees in Ecuador going back home, bringing back home into Colombia. And I heard of kind of 15,000 people, a plan for 15,000 Colombians in Ecuador to be returned. And I just leave it is on the table. We can discuss later on the timing and the appropriateness of this process. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrea. That's a really alarming picture that you paint. And I think most of the news that has sort of made it out of Colombia into the general public in recent years has been the good news about the decline in violence and progress against the FARC, but has really left out these problems around the periphery that are affecting so many people. So thank you very much. And I'd like to turn to Shayna Aber now, and she's going to talk to us about her observations in Panama.
So I just wanted to start by saying that JRS is present in Panama, Venezuela, Ecuador. We have a small operation in Brazil, and we are also present within Colombia itself. And because of that, we've come to know Colombian displaced as personally as we can know them through our accompaniment and service over the last 15 to 20 years, depending on the country. As Andrea shared, the Colombian displaced have increasingly fled over the borders into neighboring countries over the last decade. Those who flee northward from the war-torn but mineral-rich Colombian Department of Chocó in the northern portion of Colombia's Pacific coast, and those who depart from Buenaventura, Colombia's principal port city and also its deadliest city, often end up in Panama. While Panama is a signatory to the 1951 Convention, the 1967 Protocol, and regional instruments, including the Cartagena Declaration and the Mexico Plan of Action, it has the most exclusionary refugee policies of all of Colombia's neighbors. The young father pictured on the front cover of our report is one of about 800 Colombian refugees from the Jurado area in the Chocó region of Colombia, who, after years of violent abuse, several massacres and targeted persecution of town leaders by paramilitaries and the FARC guerrillas, fled their communal lands seeking refuge north of the border. This young man was 11 years old when he entered Panama with his family and his entire village, fleeing on foot and then in small boats and landing in the town of Jaque in the Darien Gap region of Panama. He remembers little of life before displacement and the conditions of his temporary humanitarian protection in Panama by the Panamanian government in 1998 and renewed in 2004 have meant that he has not been allowed to venture more than 3 miles outside of Jaque's boundaries for the last 12 years. He must carry papers with him at all times, and he is subject to a strict curfew. When we asked him about his dreams, his aspirations for the future, his face was blank at first. And after a pause, he said, to be allowed to go to Panama City. A simple dream, but a bigger dream than many young people in the community dare to hope for. The cluster of towns where the confined refugees landed in the late 90s have been called prison villages by international observers because of the limited access to rights, the constant threat of arrest and refoulement, and the absence of the most basic of services. Our delegation observed that the town of Jaque now appears to be occupied by as many militarized border police as residents. Less than a handful of humanitarian groups, including the Bishop's Vicariate and Jesuit Refugee Service, have permanent staff in the Darien, meaning that when rights violations occur, few, aside from the refugees, a group of two nuns, and a couple of JRS staff members are there to document and attempt to remedy the situation. UNHCR and the Red Cross visit the confined refugees from time to time to give orientations and sporadic assistance, but they have no permanent presence. "We live like slaves," a refugee woman told us, who looked at least two decades older than her 58 years. The refugees of the Darien complain of harassment and abuse, arbitrary detention and interrogations carried out by border police. They also are stalked by the twin hazards of hunger and inadequate health care, with health conditions to degenerative kidney disease. Even in exigent circumstances, these refugees require special government dispensation to seek emergency or specialized health services in Panama City. While a bill is pending in the Panamanian Congress to regularize the status of this population, similar language was introduced in 2005 and 2008, but failed to gain any support. Refugee rights advocates, humanitarian groups, the confined refugees, and even the Panamanian Human Rights Ombudsman's Office think that there is little chance that the bill will gain support or success this time around. The members of our delegation were dismayed by what I would call the menacing complexity of the refugee recognition process in Panama, a system that seemed to have been designed for the purpose of excluding the vast majority of refugees with bona fide refugee claims. The refugee recognition process, when it works in the way prescribed by current Panamanian law and policy interpretation, involves the following Byzantine series of steps, and you can follow along on the slide. First, the applicant approaches the government refugee office, UNPAR, to apply for admission to the refugee recognition process. He or she is then subject to a three-part written, legal, and social interview by UNPAR staff. At the end of this process, which can take up to 8 months to complete, the director of UNPAR makes a unilateral decision on whether the refugee may be admitted to the refugee recognition process. The criteria for admissions decisions are rather opaque. The UNPAR director could only tell us that he applies a rationality analysis and good judgment to cases he examines for admission. But justifications for denial of admission range from persecution by non-state actors, something that isn't recognized within the Panamanian system, and adverse credibility findings based on the substance of the claims. 9 out of 10 people will be denied at this juncture. For them, the only avenue of appeal is to the UNPAR director, the very person who just issued the denial. 10% of applicants are admitted into the refugee recognition process. For them, the next step is a comprehensive review of the applicant's UNPAR file by a National Refugee Commission composed of 8 government ministries that are supposed to meet 4 times a year. UNHCR has a voice in the commission, but no vote. While the letter of Panamanian law does not require unanimity, in practice, all 8 commissioners must agree to grant status before a refugee can be recognized. In 2010, 400 individuals presented their cases to UNPAR, only and 8 were recognized, a 2% recognition rate. The few refugees with status, 1,100 in all, are considered temporary residents in Panama. And while they have the right to work and the right to enroll their children in education, xenophobia and discrimination often exclude them from the labor market and safe and dignified housing, and a decree by the bank superintendent bars them from accessing the banking system. The vast majority of Colombian refugees in Panama City remain unrecognized, and many have been advised by legal service providers not to approach the government for recognition because chances of denial and deportation are so nearly absolute. Refugees interviewed in Panama City complained that door after door have been shut in their faces. Colombian identity is often seen as synonymous with drugs, danger, and violence. This perception was given voice during a conversation we had with a Panamanian government official, not just any official, but one of the few authorities we encountered who was sympathetic to the Colombian refugee experience and the person who will be in charge of launching an anti-xenophobia campaign this year. he stated, without irony, "It's too bad that all the criminals in Panama are Colombian, because it makes people think all Colombians are criminals. This is hard for the refugees." As few as 15,000 and as many as 100,000 Colombian refugees live underground in Panama City. In the most dangerous barrios of Panama, areas controlled by local gangs that even the Panamanian police refuse to enter. One refugee woman, a mother of three, alone with her children in Panama City, reported that her son had been stabbed 4 times on his way home from school. Delegation members found that the majority of Panamanian officials demonstrated a near complete lack of understanding of some of the most basic aspects of international refugee law, in particular the principle of non-refoulement. Panamanian officials spoke shamelessly about one troubling case in which 30 young Colombians crossed the border into Panama in October 2010, fleeing FARC guerrillas. When they arrived asking for asylum, the OMPAR director refused to allow them to access the refugee recognition process and deported them back to Colombia, saying that if they crossed the border again seeking refuge, then he might take their claims seriously. Likewise, during our trip to the Darién, the single Panamanian migration official present in all of the jungle region complained to the delegation members that the Panamanian border police had threatened to get him fired, a fate that befell his three superiors if he failed to sign an order of deportation for a small group of refugees who entered the jungle 2 weeks earlier. "I don't think that's right, do you?" he asked us. "You tell me, what is the law?" I suppose it should have been little wonder to RCUSA members that in this protection climate, the concerns of particularly vulnerable groups, like those of unaccompanied minors and refugee victims of sexual and gender-based violence, received virtually no specialized attention or services in either Panama City or in the Darién jungle. In the face of near total failure of the refugee protection regime in Panama, RCUSA members were confronted by the fact that UNHCR's resources were inadequate to meet the severe level of need found in Panama. With a limited budget totaling less than $1 million annually, too much of UNHCR Panama's scarce resources are directed towards propping up Panama's broken refugee recognition system. In Panama, UNHCR funds the salary of one Panamanian official in the OMPAR office, whose supposed specialty involves sexual and gender-based violence. This official was among only three people, all OMPAR officials, who failed to acknowledge the persistent and devastating effects of gender-based violence on refugee women and girls. UNHCR Panama is not engaging in recognition of refugees under mandate, and only 20 refugees have been settled, mostly through embassy referrals, since 2005. To address the needs of the Colombian refugees in Panama and the substantial gaps we noted in our report, UNHCR, the U.S., Canada, others in the region, and in the international donor community will need to leverage a number of strategic tools at their disposal. We must acknowledge that from the perspective of a Panamanian official, the problem is vast, and the refugee crisis is not something Panama can address on its own. There are more internally displaced people in Colombia than there are people in all of Panama, raising the specter of a near endless flow of refugees into Panama. But at the same time, the lack of political will and good faith implementation of the convention has had clear and lasting effects on all human beings who have been harmed, neglected, abused, and returned to the hands of their persecutors in over a decade of inhumane policies and practice. It is therefore absolutely imperative that the international community, especially the United States and other global leaders, elevate their concerns about this population to the highest level of diplomatic engagement while demonstrating a shared commitment to attend the ongoing and intractable humanitarian crisis. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shana. That's a bleak, very bleak picture, and one that we certainly need to have foremost in our minds. Melanie, you want to talk to us about Ecuador?
Sure. Before I do that, I just want to say two comments on what was said. First of all, about Shana, and I first met Shana, was it like 10 years ago, whatever it was, but she was advocating for this young girl in Hake who had a disease.
In her leg.
Right. She was unable to get medical care in Panama City. She was unable to get permission to travel, and that was when I first learned about what was going on there, and she was able to, through her persistence, get the girl to Panama City to get treatment. And you saw her, right?
Yeah, we saw her.
On this trip?
Yeah, on this trip.
I mean, it was a long time ago. So just point out that Shana is one of the most, the most tireless advocate for refugees in this region. And, you know, just really proud and thankful for your work. And then I just wanted to pick up on two things that Andrea said. One is I wanted to point to the photos in the back here. I just wanted you to see the picture of the refugee housing in San Lorenzo, which is the region that half our group went to. It's on the border. So basically, we all met up in Quito. I actually didn't go on the Panama trip, but met the delegation in Quito. We spent a few days in Quito, and then half of us went to San Lorenzo, which is along the border on the Pacific side of the Ecuadorian-Colombian border. And then half of us went to Lago Agrio, which is also on the border, but in the Amazon side in the east. So this is San Lorenzo, and I just wanted to point this out because this type of housing, they're paying $30 to $50 a month in rent. I mean, there are no windows, no doors, no security.
Melanie, could you describe it a little bit for our those who participate
by live stream? Oh, okay. Well, it's a suspended wooden
shack. Fishing shack, actually.
Right. You can see here all the trash underneath it. It's up about, I guess I'm not good at this, but like 15 feet maybe. And the water does come in when the river comes up. And it's like muddy, dirty water. But there are no, you'll see this whole town, there's really almost no glass. There's no windows or anything like that. But that is an extraordinary amount of money for people to pay in rent for this housing and for considering that there's 95% poverty rate in this place.
It looks like you could blow it down.
You could, yeah, and it's very treacherous. I mean, I was in heels, which was a big mistake. But, like, you know, you have to cross, like, you know, a long, like, platform almost. It's very, we were all... Really, it was very difficult to get into these houses. And, you know, there are women with children. And just so you can imagine. But, you know, we were also struck by how beautifully the women kept their homes. I mean, they were, you know, they didn't have much, but they were completely neat, completely clean, you know. And the children, you know, they did really everything they could to keep the kids, you know, in their school uniforms if they were allowed to have them. And so I just want to point that out. And the other thing, this picture, too, relates to something that Andrea said about the fumigation. This is also in San Lorenzo. This is actually at House. And we met with a group of elderly refugees. And this woman is here with her grandson. This baby's actually a twin. And you can kind of tell by looking at him, but basically half of his face is not developed, and he doesn't have an ear. He's missing an ear. Like, he has the hearing, but he doesn't have the outside of the ear. And... We spoke to a midwife, and she said she sees so many of this type of birth defect and much worse, and they all blame the fumigation. So, you know, there's a lot of controversy over whether it's actually caused any damage, and it's just hard to imagine that it hasn't when you see this level of birth defects there. So we saw this up personally, and in fact, this was the first time she had brought the baby to Hyas, and they were going to try to bring the baby to Quito. I don't know if they're going to be able to do anything for him, but so I just wanted to comment on that. And then the other thing that you said that I didn't have in my comments, but I wanted to mention, was the going home. We didn't talk to anybody who felt that they could go home. I mean, the delegation, I mean, we're spread out, but there's a group over here, and they're all shaking their heads. Everybody said... you know, it's impossible. The violence that they fled, the trauma that they had experienced. Nobody said that. We asked everybody, do you think you could ever go home? And I don't think anybody said yes. So, so that's something to think about as they make plans for repatriation. So as I said, the trip was a few days in Quito. We spoke to the embassy, UNHCR, Ecuadorian government officials. Their ombudsman, I can't know the English name for it, their ombudsman for human rights. Then we split up, and half of us went to San Lorenzo and half went to Lago Agrio. And it was really interesting to see the different situations that refugees were experiencing in the three places, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the differences. But I also wanted to say a few words about Hyas in Ecuador. Hyas started a program in 2003 in Ecuador, a very small program to provide psychosocial counseling to Colombian refugees in Ecuador. Since then, we are now providing those types of services and humanitarian assistance in 9 cities throughout Ecuador. We've also established programs in Panama and Venezuela. So basically, Hyas and JRS are the only U.S. NGOs that are providing direct services to refugees in the region. And we're also, HIAS is also the implementing partner for UNHCR to do refugee resettlement from Ecuador to Argentina, which is a small program. Talking about, just so you get a picture of the Colombian refugees in Ecuador, the total population of Ecuador is around 14 million. It's the most densely populated country in South America, and it has a 38% poverty rate, but that's countrywide. Those statistics that I could find about the border, particularly for San Lorenzo, was a 95% poverty rate, which you could see from the pictures. I mean, it's not, this is not a place that has much in the way of resources. Ecuador has 50,000 recognized refugees, which is the highest number in Latin America. 98% are Colombian. And UNHCR estimates that 135,000 to 160,000 Colombians in need of protection are living in Ecuador. So that's a sizable population in relation to the total population of Ecuador. The number continues to climb, as Andrea said. In November, when we were there, we were told that there were 1,000 new refugee claims every month filed in Ecuador. So there's no sense that this is a problem that's on the wane. And another thing to note is refugees in Ecuador do not live in camps anywhere in Ecuador. They live in communities throughout the country, and I mean everywhere throughout the country. Most of the refugees are living along the border, but they are everywhere. They've spread out throughout Ecuador, which makes delivering services very complicated. So a little bit about Ecuador's response. When I met up with the group in Quito, they were traumatized, really. I don't think we felt that way leaving Ecuador. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of challenges and a lot of hardship and a lot of really, people are living with a lot of violence, and particularly women with a lot of exploitation. But I think there's a sense of hope. I mean, Ecuador needs help, and we need to be doing more. But Ecuador has to receive some credit for the approach that it's taken to the very large influx of Colombian refugees. As I said, it's a very poor country, but it's really tried at least to take some steps to regularize the status of the refugees in Ecuador. And one of the things that it did was in 2009, it launched a year-long refugee recognition campaign known as Enhanced Registration in order to legalize the status of refugees along the northern border, thinking that if they had legal status, they'd have better access to the few services that are available in Ecuador, but certainly education, emergency health care, and that kind of thing. So the program was funded mostly by UNHCR, but the government also kicked in some money, and it was implemented in conjunction with UNHCR and the NGOs in the region. The program doubled the number of recognized Colombian refugees in Ecuador in 1 year. And the way it was done, and it's kind of inconceivable to think about something like that happening here, but they deployed mobile units to go along the border, interview refugees, and they would make a decision on the status that day and issue cards. And the total number registered that year was 27,740. That's in 1 year. And so basically along the northern border, a lot of the refugees were able to get refugee identification cards. Now, unfortunately, there were some limitations with this program, and the fact is that even though they have these cards, what does that mean in a country where it's so difficult for Colombians to access any kinds of employment services? You know, what does that give them? A couple of problems with the program was it was only 1 year long, so it ended, and although Ecuador does have the highest refugee recognition rate in the region of 66% of the asylum claims are approved, the process is very convoluted. It takes years. So it's very difficult now for people who are looking for protection. And then at the end of it, what do they get? They get this refugee card, which, again, doesn't necessarily lead to, I mean, certainly helpful, but it doesn't lead to much in the way of integration. Another side issue is that the refugee recognition was only good for a year. So by the time they finished the project, they had to start renewing all the cards. And this is a government, again, with very few resources. So the biggest problem was there was no integration program to go along with the registration and no way to address the chronic problems faced by Colombian refugees. Refugees have many, many rights under Ecuadorian law, but in practice, it just doesn't play out that way. Let's see. So some examples. Refugees in the border areas in particular are faced with rampant joblessness. There's basically subsistence farming and fishing, and that's it. There were a couple of really promising programs that are very small, mostly women working together and co-ops that were funded by JRS to, you know, to like set up sewing shops or restaurants. But again, they live in very precarious situations. One person we talked to in San Lorenzo, actually, the way he said it was, in Colombia you die by violence, in Ecuador you die by hunger. So there's really very little in the way of to support yourself. Another big issue, and so again, these problems are different in the different regions. I think there's more wealth for refugees in Quito, but San Lorenzo is where you really see in certain communities along the border the complete utter lack of work opportunities. In Quito, they may have more work, but there are other issues that are facing them there. For the group that went to Lago Agrio, I think what really struck them was the situation for women and girls. Mm-hmm. They experienced extreme exploitation in that part of the country. Lago Agrio is an oil town. There's a lot of oil money. It's mostly populated by oil men who go without their families to work. There's a lot of militarization along that part of the border. Prostitution is legal. There are 85 brothels in Lago Agrio, and I think 25,000 people. That's still a lot of, and that's just the licensed brothels, and primarily Colombian women and girls working in these situations. I'm not going to detail the harrowing stories that we heard, but we heard them, and some of them are in the report. But it's a real crisis. What was the percentage? 90-something percent of the women that you talked to in Lago Agrio had suffered some form of exploitation or abuse. This was less of an issue in San Lorenzo because there's no money in San Lorenzo. So I'm sure, we asked about it. There was a complete reluctance to talk about it, but it was clear that, you know, the absence of wealth had a corresponding absence of this, you know, broad prostitution industry. In Quito, the big problem, and again, these problems occur everywhere, but where we saw some more than others. In Quito and in the Sierra region in the mountains, where the Andean culture is actually very different from the Colombian culture, you see many more similarities along the border. Discrimination was really a huge, huge problem. And everybody we talked to had stories about discrimination in jobs, housing, education. I mean, children, nobody said that their children had Colombian friends, even if they went to school. They were, you know, harassed at school. They couldn't get into school, even though under the law they're allowed to go to school. Jobs, you know, people would say, well, I'd call for a job, but they'd hear my Colombian accent, and they'd say the job was no longer available. Same thing with housing. It's really pervasive and deep discrimination against the Colombians. The media is also portrays Colombians as responsible for all the crime in Ecuador. And the drug dealing, even though studies have shown that the Colombians have relatively low rates of criminality in Ecuador, it sounds kind of familiar. I think we're all familiar with that phenomenon. Again, along the border, discrimination is less of an issue because there's a shared Afro-Colombian, Afro-Ecuadorian culture. But, so there's no discrimination, but there's also no jobs, no housing. No, so it's different issues. Physical security threats, we found this all over, everywhere. You know, we didn't go all over Ecuador, but everywhere we went, even in Quito, which you'd think would be the safest city because it's the biggest city. There's something like 2 million people in Quito. Everyone had security concerns. Clearly most prevalent along the border, but, you know, again, some refugees felt like they weren't safe anywhere. And as Andrea said, the FARC and the paramilitaries are now in Ecuador. And what's happened is the Ecuadorian government has sent troops to the border, and instead of making it more safe, it's actually made the area more dangerous for the refugees because now they're targeted by the FARC paramilitaries and also the Ecuadorian military, who view them as conspirators. So it's just the whole situation's gotten worse. And so it's very, very unstable. Now, even despite all this instability, a lot of the refugees want to stay in the border regions for various reasons, some involving, you know, they don't feel like they can go and find work in Quito. At least along the border, there's subsistence farming, there's some food. We heard a heartbreaking story. We met this young girl, 20 years old. She had 2 children with her. She had been diagnosed with cancer, but ran out of her medication. She had been diagnosed back in Colombia. And she didn't want to leave the border to go to Quito to receive medical treatment, even though JRS and Hayes were, more than willing to bring her. because she had an 8-year-old son back in Colombia, and she didn't want to get too far from the border because she was always hopeful that she could find a way to be reunited with him. 22 years old. So there are lots of reasons why people stay along the border, even though it is so dangerous. So I know I don't have that much time, but solutions. So we outline a lot of recommendations in the report, but here are the big overall themes. Local integration may ultimately be possible for many refugees, but we are a long way from that. That was really clear. And what was interesting was the Ecuadorians felt like they had done a lot to help the Colombian refugees, but they had been completely abandoned by the international community. They felt that they had done the right thing by the refugees. Certainly, if you look at the world, they are much more welcoming than many other host communities, especially given the poverty that they have in their own country. We're not particularly welcoming, and we don't have the poverty issue. So, I mean, they should be really commended for what they've done. But they need more support. They get some support from the U.S. and UNHCR, but it's not enough. There has to be a lot more attention paid to make sure that local integration can become possible. There needs to be more of an international presence along the border. It's a system that's completely broken down. There's very little presence by the UN along the border. There needs to be a comprehensive approach to start to address these huge security issues along the border. Resettlement should be expanded from Colombia. For some reason, and I've been working on resettlement of Colombians for a long time, there always seems to be a reason why the U.S. doesn't want to resettle Colombians. When I first got to Washington, I think 12 years ago, we were talking about the issue of firm resettlement. There was a belief that Colombians were firmly resettled in Ecuador. Then it was the material support issue. I did a panel on that here. I mean, that was a long. We resolved that. We got waivers for Colombians who, under duress, provided support to the FARC, and they were able to access the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program. Then it was firm resettlement again. Then it was credibility. That seemed to be the big problem. Then it was drugs. I mean, it's very difficult if you're Colombian to show that you've never been in the same, city as which is, our immigration law is very harsh when it comes to drugs. So there's always something. And, in fact, the U.S. resettled 123 Colombians in FY 2010. That's a very small number, despite the fact that Ecuador is second on UNHCR's list of resettlement needs versus capacity. We really need to have a serious and sustained commitment, not just by the U.S., but Canada needs to recommit, and we need to make sure we expand and support resettlement in the region. Chile, Argentina, Brazil do resettlement, to make sure that the people who really are never going to be able to live safely in Ecuador, Panama, Venezuela can start their lives, because this is a conflict, again, that's been going on for 40 years. There are some people that will never be able to go back or locally integrate. One of the problems we saw is that there's no presence for refugee processing. There's no overseas processing entity, which is in other parts of the world is set up to evaluate claims, prepare claims for referrals. There's a virtual OPE, but they're totally understaffed, and I think they helped 300 people last year. So resettlement needs to be expanded. Again, we have a number of recommendations in the report. I urge you to take a look at them. But I think the bottom line is I think that we were much more hopeful after our trip to Ecuador. But, getting more funding, getting more resources is an uphill battle in this climate. Mm-hmm. But we're committed to working for it, and I hope that you – I know a lot of you are working for that as well. So thanks.
Thank you very much, Melanie. I want to open the discussion by acknowledging that I think all but one of the other members of the RCUSA delegation are here. And if any of them want to add a comment or an observation, I would welcome that now. Let me just remind you that that today's event is being video recorded as well as being live streamed. And so these questions and comments will also be part of what is posted to our website later on. So please identify yourself when you speak. Any of the members of the delegation want to add something?
I think
Bob Carey from International Rescue Committee.
I think my colleagues articulated the case very well, but I think we were struck by the fact that in both countries the asylum system is essentially non-functioning. And at every level, and so that there is an assumption that in certain instances the legal protections exist in principle, and so I think that has led to a certain complacency on the part of the international community. But the reality is those systems are non-functioning. There is no meaningful protection for Colombian refugees in either country, and there's no durable solution currently being offered. We did find it actually somewhat shocking that resettlement was not considered as an option, given the number in any significant or legitimately robust way for the many people who are in dire need of immediate protection, and many of whom have U.S. links, including U.S.-born children. So I think, just in short, the dire nature of the systemic failure cannot be, in any way, it's grave, and I think we can't express enough how grave it is.
Thank you, Bob. Joan Timoney from the Women's Refugee Commission was also in the delegation.
Thanks. Good morning. The point I wanted to make relates to livelihoods, and I think a lot of what we saw on this trip pointed to the incredible increased vulnerability and risk to women and girls when they don't have effective livelihoods programming. And related to that, particularly in Ecuador, are the poverty of the host communities that they're also living in. And so that if we're going to do this in an effective way, we somehow have to begin to marry kind of our development programming and our humanitarian programming so that we're both lifting refugees up or giving them opportunities on livelihoods at the same time that we're addressing the needs of host communities, which is important for both and also important for a protection reason, too. So I wanted to make the livelihoods point, and perhaps related to that, in both countries, particularly Ecuador, you also have incredible rates of violence against local women. And of course, then for refugees, it's just further compounded. But again, if we think about addressing the problems, we really have to think, I think, as the U.S. government, comprehensively about how we bring all our resources to bear on the development and the humanitarian side to address the issue, both as it relates to the host population and the refugee population. Thank you.
Along those lines, Joan was on the trip. We were supposed to meet with the mayor of San Lorenzo, and but he wasn't available, so his dad met with us. But and then the vice mayor joined later. But that was a point that they kept making. I mean, they were saying, these are our brothers. I mean, this is an area where there's a lot of common culture, history, families on both sides of the border. But we don't have a functioning water supply. The refugees get some rice, we get nothing. I think the point that Joan was making and that we heard again and again was, help us all. We're bearing the brunt of this by receiving this population, but we all need, the Ecuadorian people and the Colombian refugees need help. And that was the message we heard across the country.
Just to say, 1 year earlier, I did meet with the mayor, so not with this guy. He actually, for 15 to 20 minutes, he complained about the lack of water.
Yeah.
And also the insufficient program that was developed and implemented by the Organization of International Migration on the specific issue to expand the capacity to provide clean water beyond what was available because of such an increased number of the town's population. So,
I had a similar conversation with him, and I think, and
should have invited
2 years before. But I think actually it points to one of the things that we really should be pressing Ecuador to do. I don't know if it requires changing their constitution or what, but one of the ways that they allocate, that the federal government or the central government allocates resources in Ecuador is incredibly problematic and is causing some of these tensions between host communities and refugees. They allocate funding based on the number of citizens who are residents to the area. So if you think of a town like Lago Agrio, where the majority of the citizens are not declared residents of the area because they're oil men or they're mobile military brigades or they're mobile police. And the refugees compose almost 60% of the border communities along the San Miguel River. This town is not getting anything near the adequate resources to support the population that it's hosting. And the same thing is true in San Lorenzo. And so Ecuador really needs to look at that, obviously, and reevaluate it. But they did have this wonderful plan, Plan Ecuador, that was supposed to develop the infrastructure in the border regions. I think really stemmed out of discussions that they had had during the Mexico Plan of Action's evolution, and they don't have the money for it.
It's a very fundamental problem. I want to recognize Anastasia Brown, who was also on the delegation from the Migration Refugee Services of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Thank you, Kathleen. I just wanted to note that a little bit more on the issue of possibility of return and the term discrimination. The term discrimination is a little under what you really are encountering in Ecuador. The situation is really quite dire for people being, where their children are being beaten up, young men being removed from the buses by the police and everything taken from them. And the only refugee who ever said anything about going back was a woman in Quito. And she said, "I can't stand it anymore. I have to go. I probably will have to go back because at least there I'm dying in my own country." Basically, she was saying she could not survive. She couldn't put up with the violence anymore, even though she knew that she, in fact, knew people who had gone back and been killed. So it's really a little under the wire to call it discrimination. It's much more serious than that. And no other refugee, every other refugee was frightened. And the one woman in the shack said, "The only way I'll go back is if they pick my body up and throw me back across."
Thank you. Could you kindly introduce
Yes, my name is Jim Jones. I'm a former UN counter-narcotics advisor for the Andes. But more than that, I work a lot as a consultant, and I've worked all along the border, northern border of Ecuador. Was in Jaque not long after the expulsion from Jurado in Colombia. So I have some appreciation, I think, for the problem, which I think the persons on the panel have delineated quite well. Starting just the northern border of Ecuador, I'm a development person, okay? I work sometimes on security issues, but it's usually in the context of development as a response to security, and that's what I'm involved in right now, the northern border of Ecuador. It's hard for me to see that a whole lot can be done at this point along the northern border of Ecuador unless you have some fundamental change in Colombia to deal with situations that give rise to people coming across the border. I was talking with a high-level Ecuadorian official 3 weeks ago, and who happens to be in a political position along the northern border. And he said, "Look," he said, "you know, my hands are tied. I can't do anything because there's nothing on the other side of the border." That's a huge problem. Another problem is lack of resources. The U.S. government now, everything, USAID, State Department is cut. And, I don't know what the answer to that is. I think it's God bless the nonprofits, okay, who are working in these areas because what little that is being done, they're doing it. But the problems are just overwhelming. Jaque is a mess. The policies on the part of the Panamanian government, based on what you said, haven't changed much. I was there when they were rounding up Colombians using helicopters, okay, under false pretenses, taking them back and turning them loose in Colombia. And in some cases, the returnees were killed.
Yeah, I mean,
policies is a big issue. U.S. policy can do a lot, okay, to change things.
So, yeah, and you're absolutely right. We are negotiating a trade agreement with Panama at this moment. We have lots of investment in Panama. We have a lot of snowbirds in Panama as well. And I think that there really is a possibility of U.S., you know, elevating this issue. What we didn't see in Panama, which we did see in Ecuador, was that this issue had really reached a high diplomatic level. And I think that the U.S. does need to address this, especially in trade negotiations and any you know, development related projects that the needs of refugees in the Darien region and in Panama City have to be addressed. Rey Fulmont, as you said, is nothing new in Panama. There were mass expulsions in 1997, in 1998, 1996, and 2003. And now we have the drop-by-drop expulsions that happen under the radar, and there's no one there to report it, and there's no one there who's who's actually holding the Panamanian government accountable.
Thank you. We're on the side there.
Hi, my name is Lisa Schrader. I just returned from 6 months with the UNHCR in Ecuador in the resettlement unit, and I was able to meet the panelists and the committee over there. And one of the things that you've spoken about today is discrimination. But one of the things you didn't mention was more kind of racial discrimination against Afro-Colombians. And coming from the resettlement unit, I had a number of people who didn't fit through the lattice work of U.S. or Canadian requirements, so we could offer them potentially regional resettlement. And I had a number of Afro-Colombian women say, I'm not getting any further into racist territory. You need be, I want to be close to Colombia so I can return where I feel more at home. And as an American, I was just constantly wondering what sort of partnerships, what sort of possibilities can there be for these women who, it's usually women at risk, who are Afro-Colombian, experiencing extreme racism throughout all of Ecuador. What sort of potential partnerships can there be, if not just for resettlement with the Afro American community, but for programming and protection as well? Because I think that would be a huge, huge linkage.
We'll take these three. Patricia, Fagan.
U.S. Institute for Peace.
Okay. Georgetown University will do too.
I want to get back to some of the comments that Andrea made about the causes of the displacement. And to know, but for all the panelists to know a bit more about the demographics of the people on the three border, on the two or three border areas. We've only discussed two. Andrea, you said that that one of the causes, which is clearly prominent, is that the conflict among the perpetrators of displacement, if you like, the people who are fighting each other for land, for drug trade, and so on. So are these refugees forced to flee because of the ongoing fighting? Is their land being grabbed as it is in so many other parts of Colombia? If you could give some sort of a breakdown of why people are being forced to flee and what their demographic origins are. Are they all rural? That's all. Let's go.
Okay, Don?
Thanks. Don Kerwin of MPI. This is, I think, for Shana, but also for Melanie. I know, Shana, you've been going to, this region for years and years, at least since law school, as I remember, maybe even before. And it seems like, you know, in reading this, there still aren't durable solutions for these people, and there's not kind of, you know, effective development going on both for the receiving communities and for the refugees in those communities. And so my question, I think, you know, building on Mr. Jones's question, is kind of all of these recommendations, what's the one that we really need? What would make the most difference? And, you know, what are the barriers to achieving it after all, you know, really after all of these years? And for Melanie, I'm intrigued by, you know, there's always a reason why the U.S. won't resettle Colombians. And I want to ask you, what is the reason? Is it the fact that, you know, there's huge numbers of them? There seems to be an endless supply of them. Geographic proximity. What exactly is behind all that?
Thank you. Can we pause for a moment and take these three? Because I think we have one for at least each of the speakers. And if you could try to be fairly brief in your answers, I know it's difficult. Lisa had a question about extreme discrimination.
I should address that one because she's had such a history working with this population.
Okay, extreme discrimination, especially toward Afro-Colombian women.
That's definitely one of the things that's disturbed me the most visiting Ecuador is just the kind of virulent xenophobia that Afro-Colombians, but especially Afro-Colombian women experience. And I think Joan alluded to part of what we see as a solution, which is really supporting livelihoods and making sure that women have the ability and that Afro-Colombians have the ability to be independent. But there are so many hurdles. I spoke to a woman years ago, a teacher, really well-educated from Cali, whose son was assaulted at school, called names. The teacher pulled him out of the class and had all of the children circle around him and scream at him that he was a rapist. And you know, you shared the story about another woman whose child's who the children in her class are afraid to touch the child's hand because she's Black. These are things, I think, that do rise to the level that we have to resettle. It's not something that can experience a cultural shift soon enough to prevent people from being jobless, homeless, starving on the street. But I do think that Brazil does have a program that should be considered for some of these cases. I think it's going to take a lot of orientation of these people who've been traumatized by their experience in Ecuador to let them understand, you know, what the possibilities are in Brazil. I also think that the development of the border regions and really, especially the San Lorenzo area, which is Afro descent, could be a means of ensuring that local integration for Afro-Colombians will someday be possible. But obviously, that's going to be years into the future when there really is a vibrant economy on those border regions.
Okay, thank you. Andrea, do you want to?
Yes, very quickly. I mean, in terms of the causes of displacement, we're talking about three different border areas, and there are very specific causes that can happen in one area, not in another. Very quickly, in the Ecuadorian and Colombian border area, people are fleeing either because one illegal group is forcing a specific community to get engaged with illegal crop cultivation, and could be an indigenous community, could be an Afro-Colombian community. So this kind of imposure of social control and forced labor is applied to assassinating or killing some of the leaders. So either the community crosses over altogether or other leaders, they do so. It has happened for people leaving Nariño into San Lorenzo, into Ecuador, or even indigenous leaders in the southern part of Chocó, in the Baudó River, where like 4 years ago, 11 out of 12 indigenous leaders were taken all the way to Panama by church and UNHCR because every single them was on the death list, and they started to kill one, and they had to take these people away for security. It's also when there is fighting between the control of specific corridors. This is not for the production, but it's for the transiting of the produced coca, so out into Ecuador and all the way to the Pacific, and for this route. So communities might be caught into the crossfire between the other, the FARC and the same new paramilitary groups. But there are other situations. For instance, the displacement that happened in the late 90s, the refugees crossing into Panama in the northern Chocó area, it was because of the aggressive paramilitary campaign against FARC going all the way from the major river all the way up to the affluents, the different rivers. So the targeting of the Afro-Colombian community leaders or the Consejo Comunitario leadership was because Afro-Colombians were deemed by the paramilitaries as supporters of the FARC. When we come to Venezuela, for instance, the situation has changed in the last couple of years. When I was in that area a year and a half ago, the ELN and the FARC, especially in the Arauca department, were fighting each other for the control of either the contraband or the fluxus in and out of illegal items. Now, according to to recent information collected, the ELN and the FARC have reached an agreement. So this, they are applying, they continue to apply in a more systematic way social control on communities, and that we have individuals leaving for Venezuela. And something that I would like to put in on the table here is that there is no talk whatsoever about resettlement of individuals that are in Venezuela, that were leaders of communities. The demographic, I mean, can be rural when it comes rural or like fisher people or agriculturalists when it comes to the Nariño side, on the coast, on the could be indigenous community, but can also, I mean, I've interviewed many leaders, like human rights leader, IDP, international displacement communities leaders, and political leaders, Cali, in Popayan, they all go the way to Quito, or they all go the way to Caracas. And I think that there should be more attention also to these particular cases for the resettlement that might not be into the U.S., but the regional resettlement within the umbrella of the Mexico Plan of Action of 2004 that talks about solidarity resettlement or resettlement solidarity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks. And Melanie?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, in 2004... you know, the U.S. government had a plan to resettle 1,500 Colombians to the U.S. every year. That was the year where they discovered that the USA Patriot Act had been enacted 3 years prior, and that that there were bars to admission, even for people who had provided support to terrorist groups under duress. Almost nobody in Colombia had paid off the FARC under threat of serious harm or the ELN or the paramilitaries. And so that program came to a screeching halt and never recovered, you know, despite the fact that, you know, waivers were relatively early on in the process available for Colombians for the material support issue. Then it became an issue of, well, I mean, the situation, the political situation in Colombia is so complex that when DHS would go to interview people, they'd find lots of inconsistencies. I mean, some of it probably was real inconsistencies, but some of it was the situation changed so much that it was hard to get a grasp on what exactly the situation was. Did the story actually comport with what was going on in Colombia? It was very hard to figure that out. And then I guess for some reason, and your guess is as good as mine, there seems to be a lack of political will to resettle a significant number of Colombian refugees. And we're not talking about, you know, like the 10,000 Burmese. I mean, the number, you know, 2004 was 1,500 a year of people with really serious protection concerns, women at risk, you know, people who will never be able to live safely in Ecuador and Panama. I don't know. I mean, we just need to keep working on it. But it would seem to make sense that it's a relatively inexpensive place for us to go and process refugees. It's close by. We have a lot of Spanish speakers. There's no real serious security concerns. And we have people right nearby who need resettlement. Why aren't we doing it? I don't know the answer to that question.
I think Lisa Schrader, who worked on resettlement for UNHCR once, very briefly, please.
So the main reason that we were unable to, no one ever fit through. First, you have to have, when I speak of this lattice work, you have to filter people through. So first, there's extreme, you have to do a serious credibility analysis of the region. They're often coming from regions where journalists have been killed for years, so we're relying on random internet and blog reports often. Then you have to have someone who's never paid a vacuna, which is the tax that is imposed by illegal armed groups. Then you have to have someone who has never been involved in survival sex or prostitution. You have to have someone who has never even been near coca, cocaine in any way, shape, or form, even if they were forced by the FARC and it's the only crop there. And then, in addition, you need to be fleeing from something, and you need to be able to prove what you are fleeing from, and you need to be supported by the UNHCR. Once you reach all of those criteria for resettlement, you're potentially resettled to the United States. And I can tell you the number that shake through are far fewer than the quota. We never meet quota.
So yeah, I mean, that's a very good explanation. Thank you, Lisa.
I mean, if you think of it, too, I mean, so many Colombian claims, and when you become familiar with Colombian claims, they're like, the armed men came. Okay, what armed men? The armed men came. Armed men came and killed my grandfather two generations ago. Am I going to stay and find out which armed men they are? You know, there's just a lack of understanding of the fact that this is an almost 50-year civil war, and it has had severe impacts on the social well-being of people. Okay. I wanted to answer Don's question really
quick.
Okay, very briefly. And then, so durable solutions. I mean, I'd love to say it really needs to be strategically deployed between local integration and resettlement. But I think that we have the Mexico Plan of Action as a wonderful framework that Ecuador actually has tried to take the first few steps to apply. They did a registration campaign. That was actually something called for in the Mexico Plan of Action. They said that they wanted to develop infrastructure in the borders for the solidarity border part of the Mexico Plan of Action. And the part of the Mexico Plan of Action that has never come to bear, well, there are two parts. One is solidarity resettlement. It has been really low. I mean, the capacity in the region apparently is way lower than we thought it would be. It's like 60 persons a year to each of these resettlement countries. And the other part of the Mexico Plan of Action that they called for and they thought that they would get once they started to implement these steps was support from the international community. And they said support not just from, you know, the international community in general, but from development actors and from the major donor community. And that's something that has really been lacking.
Okay. Gentleman on the aisle there, thank you. You've been very patient.
Ling Lee Williams, U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, and also one of the trip participants. I have two quick comments about children and youth. I think it's fair to say that in both Ecuador and Panama, the plight and needs of unaccompanied children were an afterthought at best. It appears that basically when they are identified, they get scooped into whatever system exists for the children of the region, and no one was quite able to tell us exactly what happens to them farther on in the process. Related to a comment that Joan made earlier about the need to link development both with the host community as well as the refugees, also ties in with youth. I was with Shana and other members up at Lago Agrio, and one of the things that really struck me was in talking with UNHCR in the region, there are either 42 or 24, I can't remember which, primary schools within Sucumbíos province where Lago Agrio is, but there are only two secondary schools. So you've got not only all of the refugee kids, but also the Ecuadorian children who finish primary school, and then what? They have no opportunities for jobs, education, whatever, which makes them prime candidates to end up linking up with either the FARC or some other paramilitary or criminal element, because there's just nothing else for them to do.
And that was really echoed. There was a woman who, I mean, her child, against all odds, graduated from high school, and she pulled me aside after one of our chats and said, how do I get my daughter into the university? Because she can't stay in this town. She's going to fall into bad things. And, I mean, that was just so heartbreaking for me. I didn't have an answer. I said, talk to Hyatt.
Break their hearts. Okay, could we have just three quick comments or questions here, back in the corner there, and Bob has one more, and then I'm afraid we're going to have to...
Thank you. Just briefly, my name is Sarah Plastino. I'm a second year at Georgetown Law, and I spent last summer at Asylum Access in Quito, and I actually just wanted to point out that Asylum Access is providing direct services in Ecuador as well, direct legal services, mainly appealing refugee denials, but as Melanie pointed out, one of the things that I was struck most by was the inadequacy of legal protection and the, you know, the dire need for physical protection. So, I mean, I'm sure everyone in this room could share their own anecdotes, but I just wanted to really briefly share mine regarding physical protection, specifically for Afro-Colombians. I had one client who the paramilitaries who killed his cousin and brother were coming to the desk at the hotel where he was in hiding. So echoing the need for resettlement, also regarding the discrimination that rises to a whole nother level, I had a Colombian woman who tried to get a gynecologist appointment for her ovarian cysts, and the doctor at the public hospital said, why do you need a gynecologist appointment? Are you andando en la calle? Are you acting as a prostitute? And refused to see her. So just, you know, further examples of what has been spoken today. Thank you.
Thank you. Back in the corner. Thank you.
Hi, Annalise Romoser with Lutheran World Relief. Thank you for your presentations and for your tenacious advocacy on these issues. Can you talk a little bit more about U.S. funding for to deal with the displacement issue within Colombia and then the refugee issue more broadly in the region, and the trends you've seen in that funding, challenges we're facing, and what we need to do to ensure that the resources are that they're spent effectively.
Okay, let's have one Bob's comment, and then.
Yeah, I just actually wanted to uncharacteristically end on a somewhat positive note, in that when we talk about solutions, we did see some positive examples of programs not to scale, not nearly adequate, but even the highest program, which I think is an ideal in Quito as an example, or the JRS program, excellent models of services to refugees in urban settings, which I think should be explored and replicated. I also think we saw a dramatic difference in the level of U.S. engagement in Quito, as my colleagues mentioned, and in Ecuador and in Panama. In Ecuador, we met with the U.S. ambassador. She was totally versed in the issues and totally engaged on them if the resources were not adequate. In Panama, by contrast, we met with a recently hired accompanying spouse who was not well-versed in the issue, and that was part of her portfolio. So the level of engagement was dramatically different, and I think that's, while not a solution, we do think the elevation of these issues at a higher level in bilateral diplomacy, resettlement, part of an issue, not just resettlement to the U.S., but I think that will also elevate the broader protection issues. It's not just about resettlement, but it's about, you know, leveraging durable solutions and strategic use of resettlement.
Thank you very much for that comment, Bob. I want to give our panelists a chance to make a quick last comment, and during that course, if you could please address the during the course of that, if you could please address the question of resources.
I can start very, very briefly on the funding for IDPs, internally displaced person programming from the U.S. government. The funding has been slowly decreasing in the last few years, from 40 million to 36 million right now. At least the figure I got 2 weeks ago is 36 million from this year.
For the whole Western Hemisphere?
No, I'm talking about IDPs.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking about only funding for internally displaced persons inside Colombia. I have more good news than bad news this time, because the IDP team in Colombia has a new leadership and has been looking backwards and trying to identify all the lessons learned from the previous 8 to 10 years of work with IDP communities. They realize that they need to be filling gaps with this money. They need to be strategic in the use of the resources. And they also the team has decided to incorporate a series of recommendations that were put forward by an independent evaluation team that did the research at the end of 2009 and produced a report at the beginning of last year. I think one of the researchers is here in the room. I'm very pleased to say that some of those recommendations are going to be integrated, and I foresee a much more effective and a much more targeted use of these resources on IDPs. The overall USAID programming has been restructured now. This 36 million includes vulnerable population, these IDPs, a small portion of former combatants, and also other vulnerable groups like victims of landmines and specific communities. So I'm positive on that. The point is that this is now the time to interact as much as possible with the team, because they are finalizing the strategy, and they're going to send around the tenders for application for NGOs in the programming. Two quick points to wrap up. I wanted to pick up the first question from Mr. Jones. The question here is the causes of the displacement, what's happening in Colombia. We are 7 months into a new administration in Colombia. We haven't yet talked about that. From our perspective, in terms of interaction and interlocution with the Colombian authorities, we have seen a progress. We have seen a different language from the Santos administration. We have seen legislative initiatives right now in terms of the victim law and the land law. So we are mildly hopeful that something might change. We don't know what. We don't know if this is going to lead to a negotiated solution of the internal armed conflict. That would be, from our perspective, the the final result to bring an end to this conflict. But I would like to say that there is much more room to work with the Colombian authorities. There is much less polarization right now in the public, and this can be an opportunity. We didn't talk about in this discussion in terms of Colombia about the recent floods. There are 2.5 million people affected by floods right now in Colombia. So this is maybe another panel. And then final point, and the question that came from this gentleman, durable solution. Well, there is a framework available, the Mexico Plan of Action. In November of last year, several non-governmental organizations from the region and from the U.S., we called the conference to look at the protection needs of four displaced people in the region, in Latin and Central America. And this conference took place in Quito. There were 150 participants, including 14 governments, and it was solely led and implemented by civil society. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of a path we should go forward. In the final declaration of the conference that I have here, I can give you a copy. There are several ideas and recommendations how we can go towards durable solutions.
Thank you.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about two things. One is that conference, when we were in San Lorenzo, we met with a group of women, Ecuadorian and Colombian, who had joined together to form a sewing co-op that was guided by JRS. And it was a really wonderful program. And they had this dream of making enough money to buy a small plot of land where they could put their houses. And it was mostly single women and their children, and they could live together. And they were a support network for each other. It was a great thing. And one of the things they said to us during our meeting was that they needed a generator. So we were thinking about that. And then when we got back to Quito, we were at the conference. We ran into one of the women that had come to the conference. And she said, I just talked to somebody from Canada, but they're going to buy it. We're going to get a generator, you know. So just making those contacts. And the other thing I want to say is we're very, very worried about what Congress is going to do for funding for humanitarian aid, for the Migration and Refugee Assistance Account, IDA, the Office of Refugee Resettlement. The House passed spending bill for FY11 would cut migration and refugee assistance by 45%, which would mean basically they couldn't do anything for the rest of the year. I think on the RCOSA website there should be an action alert. If not, there's one on the highest website. Contact your senator, member of Congress, and say, please keep up humanitarian assistance funding, because we're in a real critical time here for FY11 and also for FY12 in terms of making sure that our government understands that this is a very important area that needs to continue funding. There's not a lot of money in going to Ecuador to help with refugees, but what money there is mostly is coming from the U.S. So it's really critical to keep that funding.
Okay. Shana, last word.
Okay. So two things happened a few days after we left from the delegation. One was that Panama recognized its first Colombian refugee of 2010. She was a woman who was the head of the DAS, the security police in Colombia. She was being charged with spying on a number of civil society organizations and political parties, and she was the sole Colombian refugee who was recognized by the Panamanian government last year. She was being prosecuted by the Colombian government, and the Colombian government said, vociferously objected to that refugee recognition. Another thing that happened, which was, I guess, only about 10 days after we left, was that Alfonso Morales, who is the Director General of Refugees in Ecuador, announced that Ecuador spends $40 million a year caring for Colombian refugees. We don't have the resources to care for this population, and we're very interested in a Colombian government proposal to assist in the return of 15,000 Colombian refugees to Cauca, Nariño, and Putumayo. These are three departments in Colombia that are very much still in the center of the war, where the highest rates of displacement outside of Chocó are currently happening. So I think that it's come to a crisis. It's come to the point where we really have to act. And thanks, Annalise, for bringing up the MRA account. I think that migration and refugee assistance in general is getting cut and slammed across the board. But unfortunately, in past years, the administration really both administrations, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, really haven't listened to our advocacy, asking them to please invest the requisite amount of funding to really meet the magnitude of the crisis. And one of the ways to point this out is that in the president's request for FY12, while MRA overall, migration and refugee assistance overall, was cut by 13%, the Western Hemisphere, where Colombian refugees are, suffered a 23% cut in the presidential determination. And that's before Congress gets its hands on it.
Not an encouraging note on which to end, but certainly a rallying cry. And before I close the panel, I just want to remind you that this conversation will be available on our website at migrationpolicy.org, the video. So if you want to review any of this or recommend it to others, please ask them to visit that site. And I also want to draw your attention to the notice that you have for MPI's 8th Annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference, which will be taking place on April 26th. So, again, visit our website for details, and we hope to see you there. It's co-sponsored with the clinic and the Georgetown University Law Center. So please join me in thanking our panelists for a fascinating, very substantive discussion.
For information on MPI's refugee protection program, please visit migrationpolicy.org/research/refugee.